I'm a researcher, true and true. So I was like, let me go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Okay. So when I looked at software engineering and software development, you know, it's growing quite fast over the 5-year period that I was looking at it. But the number of developers in the millions in the US. And then I looked at information security, hundreds of thousands. So immediately what that told me was that supply and demand. Exactly. We are making things exponentially faster than we are securing them.
You get your first, we can say this is your big
cyber job.
Corporate cyber job.
Yeah. Like my first week was Log4j. And I was on the application security.
Oh, yeah, you had a lot of fun.
I was the only team member hired. Like, it was my hiring manager who was in Foster City, California. And it was me and Austin during Log4j.
Welcome back, everyone. This is episode 127 of the Textual Talk Podcast. I'm your host, HD. For you guys that do not know me, I am a cybersecurity professional and a career coach and also podcaster. But today we have a lovely guest for y'all. Her name is Miss Tiffany Savage, and she has an interesting background. We're going to get into it. But if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, please like the podcast, leave us a review to help us out in the podcast analytics. Now, if you're watching on YouTube, like most of you guys do, subscribe, hit the bell icon so you can be notified when we're dropping everything. And look, I said it last episode, I want to say it here. I need y'all to comment, and I need y'all to join the Patreon. This is how we keep on giving y'all this good content, this high-quality content. But, you know, YouTube ain't paying for this. I'm coming out of my own pocket. So if y'all like the content, tune in and help us out. But, Tiffany, what's going on?
Nothing. I haven't been in Dallas in years. This was the first place I ever got on a plane to travel to. I was on a youth retreat to Dallas, my first plane ride ever. So I'm happy to be back.
Okay. Yeah, we talked before this a lot about other different things. So I presume that you were involved with the church a lot.
I used to be. I grew up in the church. My grandmother had a really solid church home. First Baptist Church.
Had a praying grandmother?
I had a praying grandmother.
Okay. Let me find out you was you like Fighting Temptations, that movie?
I do like Fighting Temptations, but I have kind of the Fighting Temptations vibe right now, actually.
You do.
With my little Beyonce blend. Braids, but yeah, I grew up in the church. It was a good foundation for me. My parents didn't go that often, but this was a church that they married in and the church that my father grew up in. So it immediately was like a warm place for me. And I feel like I had an encounter with the Holy Ghost, and it was just very comforting when you're kind of like stressed or going through growing pains. And for me, that was really positive. And not like a lot of people, you know, as you grow up, you kind of drift away, you get into the world, you go to school, you're having all these experiences. But most recently, I definitely have gotten back into my word, you know, found a church home, definitely, you know, redeveloping, growing a prayer life. So I am like, you don't love God? I love God.
So with you.
Okay, what's wrong with you?
But could you introduce yourself to everyone?
For sure. So my name is Tiffany Savage. As stated, yes, that is my real government last name. I'm from Washington, D.C. I went to Howard University, studied liberal arts. So no computer science background here. Communications, strategic, legal, and management, a little poli-sci and a business background. After that, I joined the military. So I've actually also served as an intelligence analyst for the U.S. Army. And following that, I got a business degree, my MBA, and got picked up by Amazon and have done some non-technical operations, a little bit of robotic fulfillment all across the country. And then during COVID, I was fired. Yes. 15 months of unemployment made me reevaluate my employment situation. And then I got into cybersecurity. I started off in the payments industry and incident response on the blue side of things, doing secure and static code analysis, SSDOC. And I most recently have moved over to the dark side, to red teaming and ethical hacking. And yes, I also serve as a cybersecurity career coach. I have a boutique firm, Cybersecurity Babe, and we help the underrepresented and minorities understand cybersecurity, implement secure practices, and get gainful employment and experience in the industry.
Nice spiel. You said a lot.
I did.
And I wanted to, well, as I was listening to you talk, like I said, I could see why she picked communications.
Mm-hmm. I'm a chatty Cathy, for sure.
Not only that, certain people have the voice, the look. Mm. Did you grow up looking at like news anchors or news women or journalists and say like you want to go like into communications?
I did not. I didn't. I did have a lot of early like engagement with news media. I'm actually adopted. So I was adopted from Howard University Hospital. And my mother actually worked at Howard University Hospital. So we did a lot of kind of, you know, exposés and news pieces. Now that I think about it, that was talking about like my biological mother, how my mom actually adopted me through the HUH Cares program and what that was like, you know, in DC in the 80s with, you know, the war on drugs and how the addiction and the poverty and the crime had really taken root in that city. And so now that you mention it, like I've pretty much been in front of a camera from a very young age, but I didn't think news media. I actually had like I wanted to be like Mary J. Blige, like Brandy, like I wanted to be an entertainer. So maybe so much performing, so much just like getting up on stages, like singing, rapping, dancing in front of everybody probably became like my superpower, even if I was nervous or like I did have social anxiety. But there was something that was like, still, I'm gonna show up like this, like you won't be able to tell. So I guess this is how it's just manifested over time. And you just learn how to trust your voice, and you only get one voice. So briefing in the military helps. I mean, that's probably as close to news as I can get. Like, okay, very high pressure situations where you're writing information, synthesizing it, and then you're speaking to it at like these, you know, global audiences with the, and the implications are very serious. So that was probably some of the most important work also, now that I think about it, that I've ever done. And probably the most, you know, preparation that I've done is just to kind of feel comfortable with information of a certain gravity and be able to communicate it concisely.
Got it. So how was going to Howard?
It was amazing.
Like, you know, you guys are like always probably like, what y'all gonna say, top two and not two
when it comes to everything? I want everyone to feel like that about where they spend their money to go to school. But and it's not without it's, I'm not one of those Howard alumnus who don't have any critique for the university, because I truly do, especially as a native Washingtonian. I went to high school across from Howard University. I was born there. So I have a lot of experience in observing the processes, financial trends, the strategies, right, over the years. And I have my critique of it. But as far as spaces that bring Black people and people of color or allies together, I mean, it's a very special place. I think historically, knowing that this is coming directly out of Reconstruction to advance our people is major. Again, we could score them on how well they're doing, but that is a part of the university system, is that the activism and the flexibility to say, okay, what do Black people need to advance? How can we be that? But how can we continue to shift? Because it's not going to be like the perfect circumstance to get that work done, even if it's academia, even if it's with our young people. So yeah, Howard's the best in its own right.
That's good. That's good. I always talk about how when I came out of high school, they did a horrible job of really introducing us to HBCUs.
Really?
Yeah, I'm from Shreveport, so the only ones I really knew about were Grambling and Southern.
Okay.
I didn't even know about the other ones, even in my own state.
Dang.
The Dillards and the
Xaviers. Did you have guidance counselors?
They didn't do a good job.
Shout out to amazing guidance counselors. I've had amazing guidance counselors in the public charter system in D.C., as well as in my high school was public. It was considered a magnet school, but it was public. And the guidance team is, I mean, since middle school, we've been going on college tours. We've been thinking through, okay, what is the pathway? What are the steps? Even in your eighth grade year, what type of math and what type of aptitude? And just making best use of the curriculum. Curriculum, again, these things are not going to be perfect, but there's a lot that can be done to paint a picture of, say, hey, you know, what is Omri good at? What is he really like doing? And what programs that we know of now support a good pathway into that? And then what are the outcomes? And I think that's where the guidance counselors come into play heavily. And they have the opportunity to create relationships with universities to create legit, like we talk about pipelines, corporate now, like, okay, from the university to the corporation, but it really should go all the way back to, you know, early education guidance to say, Tyree is making puzzles. How can we get Tyree into a math and science STEM middle school? Yeah. how can what middle schools have a relationship, you know, I mean, what high schools are going to, you know, pipeline him into positivity as opposed to the other way. Because we know we got the pipelines that's negative.
Yeah. But I think that also you're bringing up good points. But then now if you take a step back and think about what state I come from and like we like last in education and probably got so many people.
Slavery.
So it's one of the things. My state is meant to stay down. It's only meant to get people drunk, fat.
I don't like that.
None of us that's from there like that, but the people that's in charge, that's kind of how it is.
Yeah, and that's not like any other city now that I'm thinking about it, but a lot of times what I've observed is those of us who are educated and who have that context tend not to stay in those spaces. And I think, to be real, the only way that you actually create that change is to stay in those spaces, because then you're getting, then you, you know, hopefully get those tax dollars flowing in, get some salary, get some things going, and then you can have impact on stuff like that. Okay, now you're raising your kids, you own property in this space, and it's like, well, I don't want that curriculum wise. And it's I'm gonna sound like a real DC person, but like, you gotta be in the PTA, you gotta be in the school board meeting, you have to be on the council meetings, you have to be in your community saying no.
So yeah, but this is one of those things that goes back to, I always tell people, like, we always know all this stuff always go back to money. Mm-hmm. So like, coming from, like, Louisiana is the only state in the country that we don't have counties. We have parishes.
Mm-hmm.
So mostly in our parish, it's mostly consisted of Shreveport. Now, if you start looking at the demographics now from when I was in school in the 90s to now, it's totally different.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these parents are younger.
Mm.
Most of them might be working one or two jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Income level is low. These kids don't know basic things, but the parents can't be involved, one, because some of them don't care. Two of them, some of them don't have the time. So it's a lot of those different things that's going down. And if I also go back to my point about high school, also the HBCUs, for whatever reason, weren't the people that would send me the mail to my house to come to their program.
That's real.
It was the LSUs. It was the Baylors. It was, I forgot whoever else. They were the ones that were like sending me the stuff. But I was still smart enough back then, like, yo, we don't got that much money. I ain't finna go spend all this money to go to LSU.
Like, mail marketing is expensive. I mean, like, the same, and it's like, okay, I'm critical of Howard, I'm critical of HBCUs, but the same constraints that face the community are the same constraints that face the institution at a different level of analysis. So it's like, we are all kind of like fighting the fight at different levels.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that, you know, there are not challenges to having this impact, but I think that's when our like inherent like community centric, like the how community centric that I think our people can be, it suits us. Because okay, if, you know, back in the days, like if a mom with young children had to work, she had like a trusted community member who could watch the kids. It was one person, it was probably two people that was always at the community church meeting, and they were the vested voice of that neighborhood when they said, oh, we want to build XYZ. It's always going to be that trusted community member that is having tea with you, that's having dinner in all of the households, and they can be there because that's their instrument. That's how they instrument themselves in a community to make the impact. So
right.
It's not just at an individual level.
Definitely. And this could be like a whole like podcast on its
for
own.
For sure.
But like, after I make this point, we'll get into some other part of the conversation. But now, let's even take it another step further. When I was growing up, most of my family were all in the same city.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time, my city had manufacturing. They had a GM plant. Mm-hmm. They had all these different things. People were there. They're making good livings.
Mm-hmm.
And you could, you know, even though I made the joke earlier about like, you know, what's a babysitter and all the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I still had some. My family's big. Like, my dad's side of the family, 23 brothers and sisters, mm-hmm. same mom and daddy.
Mm.
A lot of cousins.
That's a lot of kids.
A lot of cousins.
Y'all had family reunions?
They had like one.
Oh my gosh, y'all need somebody to organize a family reunion at that point.
Now my mom's side, we always had them on. My granddad's side, my grandma's side, like, so every 2 years we was going to different places. So it was fun meeting my cousins. But any given time, grandma was there, she could help out, or my aunts or something like that. But now, because the economies and people's home cities have gotten so bad, mm-hmm. people are moving around. Like my little girls have really only met a handful of like, you know, their cousins.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not going to grow up the same way that I did.
Yeah, they do miss that. I mean, I grew up the same way. My mother and father's family, they're from the same neighborhood. Mm-hmm. My father's side migrated from Virginia, Southern Virginia. My mom's family, North Carolina. So this is like great, great. Moved to the there and now they're in the DC area and they ended up in the same neighborhood. So I was raised with all of my cousins. Mm-hmm. And while my, you know, this is my adopted family, but that's my blood. I've been with them since I was 6 months. So that's my family. So we grew up all in my granny's house. So we all went to the same elementary school. Mm-hmm. We all they had days where so-and-so picked up the kids and made sure that everybody got their food. They're after, you know, school snacks and did their homework, or we all went to granny's house and we did things on the weekend together. It wasn't like, this is your kid, this is my kid. It's, hey, we're going to do this activity. Can Tiff go or whatever, what have you. So I agree with you. I even miss that. Like, I miss my cousins. Every time I go to DC, I'm like, can we just all do something? Yeah. Like, I don't, but everyone, they have their own children. That's so I'm like, part. I'm the one still living my best life with no kids. And I'm like, every time I go back, there's a new little cousin. Like, I'm like, y'all are populating the earth.
Yeah, when I was younger, I used to like wonder, like, ask my dad, like, why you don't go hang? Like, we got our guy land, and so we could go down to the land and mm-hmm. go do stuff like that. But then he got older, he didn't hang out with them as much. And I didn't mm-hmm. see him. He was like, when you get your own family one day, you'll see. And so everybody, like you say, everybody's busy. So sometimes I'm back in the city, but this person's working, this person's bad. And we have had times where we're all together and we have like really like a lot of fun. Like,
right.
I was the only child for a long time, for like 12 years. So
oh, wow.
My two closest cousins, they're a year older than me. They were like my brothers.
Yeah.
And like, we still like talk a lot now, like throughout the week about different stuff. Or like,
that's nice.
And all of us were also musicians at our home church.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
We're like bonded. We play football and all the stuff together. So,
and it's a blessing. Family is a blessing.
Yeah, I agree. So I want to get back into you finishing up at Howard.
For sure.
So when you graduated, did you already decide you were going into the Army then, or did you take a stab at trying to find a job first?
So I had a really roundabout undergraduate time. I was at Howard for my freshman and sophomore year, and then I actually left school, and I thought I was going to be a model, and I moved to New York, and then I was broke for like a week, and I was like, I can't.
You said a week.
New York is very tough. Like, without any financial help.
Oh, yeah.
As a young woman of 19 years old.
Oh, yeah.
It's not sweet. So like, and I tell people all the time, I'm like, could I have stayed? For sure. But it would have took a lot out of me. And so I came back to DC and, you know, worked a few odd jobs and was like working in the clubs and like having a time. And then it was like a year passed and I was like, I got to do something else. Like, it didn't take me long personally to be like, I need to finish school. I need to get, suitable housing. I need all the things. I need a salary. And DC, like now I'm just scared of how people make it in DC now, because even then, you know, gentrification was well underway. DC has always been one of the most expensive and condensed cities to live in. So it was really difficult. So I thought, I just started brainstorming like, what can I do? What can I do? And my eldest brother actually served in the military too. And while he actually was medically retired at the time and has been pretty much since maybe 2012, 2013 or so, actually much earlier than that, maybe 2003, excuse me. Even though he had, you know, that medical retirement experience, I talked to him. I let him know what I was trying to do. He said he thought it would be a good idea. That's the only person I asked. So I was like, I'm going to the military. And I literally had like a job at Red Lobster in Silver Spring. Y'all know what I said. For a day. And I walked out of that Red Lobster and I walked up the stairs in this shopping plaza, and there was an Army recruiting office. And I was like, sign me up. I'm ready to go. And I took the aptitude test. They, you know, did my like BMI. They're like, you're perfect. You're perfect for this. And so they're like, you're going to do intelligence. And I'm like, okay. Like, I was like, I'll be able to get a decent job when I get out, if I get out, you know. And then it came time to like, it went really, really fast. It came time to choose my contract length. And I was thinking 6, 8, like, I was like, I want to go with the shortest one. I don't know if I'm going to like this. Like, everything went so fast. And I pretty much shipped off in like January of 2011. And I was there for 3 years and 8 months. And it was probably one of the better decisions that I made because of how it equipped me just to be completely independent pretty much from 2011 forward.
Look at you. I was over there. growing up around that time, I think I might have been like a sophomore in college.
Yeah, I was like 21. My friends were having, like, I mean, those first 2 years of college for me were, like, those were my crazy years.
Everybody's.
After that, it was, like, I mean, I don't know how people did 4 crazy years, because I only had 2, and I was like, y'all got it.
I only had 1, and that's because all my friends was there.
I only had 1. I don't believe you. That was your craziest one, but,
because, like, for everybody, like, because I was on quarter system, so it was quarter system freshman year.
What's that?
Quarter system is, so you know, you're familiar with like first 9 weeks, second 9 weeks?
Oh, you have like quarters instead of semesters?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you can graduate faster. So,
oh, nice. So you was expedited. Like,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because I went in 2010, fall of 2010, and then I graduated in the fall of 2013.
Okay, so you did a 3-year process.
Yeah, so I was 21. And yeah, that, I don't know, like we always talk about like the funny stuff or things getting into or how stuff
came around. Absolutely, like, we were nuts. Our brains were soft. Like scrambled eggs.
Yeah. But I tell people all the time, I do still feel like that is some character development.
For sure.
Because I see a lot of older, you know, people, and we're not going to get into this too much, but, like, you know, women, men, I feel like either they didn't go to school, they didn't get a chance to kind of
have that, get some of that play out of them. Social experience and experiment.
Because when you think about it, right, and we'll get about the job search and everything else, when it comes down to a lot of the stuff in the job search, it comes from being able not to be scared and network and present yourself and for people to like you. Mm-hmm. And those are things, when you go to a new school, sometimes you don't know nobody. Mm-hmm. So how are you going to maneuver and meet people and build up your network?
Yeah, it's a key social, you know, key social skills that you can learn when you go to university. Like, it's your world. Like, you're creating your independent identity from the family that you grew up and cohabitated with. And it was important for me. It was a difficult process, and I'm happy I got to even finish. I went back and finished. I chose to, you know, go back to Howard, even though it had gotten exponentially more expensive. I choose to go back and finish what I started, so to speak. And the institution means a lot to me. And I could have went to any school. I always think about that. But for me, the challenge was, how can I keep my focus? Like, I pretty much learned most of what I needed to know in high school. I went to a very competitive high school, but I wanted the focus. I wanted it to be grounded in, like, how can I impact my community and how can I remain critical of these institutions and systems that I'm going into? Like, how do I continue to be a change agent? Like, I want that to be the cornerstone of my education and my career. So it was really, really important for me to be there and to, like, just be there and experience the air and meet the different people. Like, there's every type of Black person that you could ever think of at Howard University. It's like, we are not a monolith as a people, and it allowed me to really live and see that.
Right. Yeah, a lot of my HBCU friend graduates say that, like, mm-hmm. they went to a place that could be theyself. So that's cool. So now we're going to fix that on the Army real quick. 2 things. 1, the fact that you did an actual important job, intelligence analyst. And I said that I had to preface it with important because I have people that do different jobs that come to me, like they are either firemen mm-hmm. or they're policemen. And mm-hmm. sometimes they are thinking about, like, their experience in some ways. Like, well, I know I don't have experience. And I'm like, wait,
but you,
your job's super important. So I want you to, like, I would tell them, I want you to focus on, like, how important your job is. Like, it's even mm-hmm. people that, like, support the police department IT thing. I'm like, your job is important. Like, if yes. the IT stuff go down, they can't put in these tickets. They can't help. I was like,
yes.
So I want people, like, to think about, like, not really downplay their job just because they don't think it's, like, super important or it's not cool or cool name. But
true,
your direct job is very important. And I do have another question about, like, mm-hmm. I wonder why, like, you didn't choose to do, I guess, like, you know, threat intelligence.
Mm-hmm. After the military.
So, Tiffany, how was it being an intelligence analyst in the Army?
It was a lot of pressure, but at the time I was really looking for, like, a lifestyle completely opposite of where I was coming from, which was, like, young, you know, in the club, like, fast life. So I was looking for discipline and, like, responsibility, and to kind of, you know, leaving school for me was, like, I thought that was the end of my world. Because I've always been, like, you know, into my schooling, and that has always been, like, a major pride point for me. So I was looking to get back there accomplishment wise. And I found a lot of, like, self-importance in that role, to be honest with you, because again, like the information that I'm communicating is not light. And that's why now I do such a good job. I'm like, I don't care about whether you go live or not, you know, with our security assessments. It's not life or death. It's a product. But, you know, then it was 100% life or death. Especially during my deployment to Kuwait. And I was working for a larger military organization than I was when I was stateside. And the briefing process for me was one that really probably changed my life, because it allowed me to use my critical thinking skills. And they do train us very well and very intensely, but essentially it was on me to, let's say, look at a country of 20, excuse me, look at an AOR, an area of responsibility of 20 countries. And then, you know, along political, military, economic, social, biomedical, and then later on cyber, right? Along those lines, what is like the most important and impactful information that has happened over the last 24 hours? Then I have to communicate that to someone in a way that's concise. And for me, you know, and I've been, you know, post-Army diagnosed with non-clinical PTSD, because when you're taking in so much information that is not sunny, rosy news, it involves the death, not only of soldiers, but of, you know, civilians and children, the destruction of spaces and areas that are older than we can even imagine, and just definitely like catastrophic events. But how do I then synthesize that into something that is understandable and actionable? So there was a lot of pressure, but I took a lot of pride in being chosen for that work and being able to successfully do that. It was everything. And coming from Washington, D.C. at the time, I was dating someone that was in politics, and it was a thing, because it really lets you know, like, hey, the news is not objective. And so I would often find myself in this, like, hey, that's not true space. But you know, you can't tell people that, because, you know, there's a classification level to things, yeah, that I was working with. So some of the most important work that I've ever done, in my life, for sure. And, I worked with a lot of great people, but definitely a brain breaking situation.
Yeah. That's, kind of reminds, like, of course, like line of work that we're in now.
Yeah.
Certain things you just know, you can't tell nobody, you can't talk about.
Right.
But something you said really piqued my interest. You said non-clinical.
Yes. Non-combat.
Non-combat PTSD.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
No worries.
But the reason why I said that, right, and when you said all this information you've been taking and it's depressing stuff.
Absolutely.
I thought about, from the period of time, the like mid-2010s, mm-hmm, when every other day, all they were showing on TV was somebody black dying.
Absolutely.
And stuff like that, which I had, like, I don't even watch when things happen anymore.
Yes.
Because of that.
Yes.
And that made me think how, at a point, even though it's like people ain't supposed to die, but you just kind of got like used to people dying, mm-hmm, and you ain't supposed to be used, like,
well, these violent deaths.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're supposed to die.
Yeah.
But
in the way that they was doing that, showing it so much, it's like, yeah, you kind of numb to it.
Yeah. I mean, that's my reaction to certain platforms too. As you know, like, because of our line of business, we do have to, you know, inhabit certain spaces on these platforms, but they're products, and some of what is being output on the product can cause some of the same mental anguish.
Yeah.
If you're being confronted with, information and video specifically, is something that worries me. That is violent, overtly violent or sexual in nature. Like, these things do have an impact on us.
Yeah, definitely. They, mm-hmm, they do. And I don't, a lot of people don't, well, by the time they don't even, they probably don't care or don't, mm-hmm, understand, but it's really more so for the younger people.
All of the above.
Think about, yes, we talk about music, and then if people really want to get music theory.
Yes.
We do know certain music can impact on your mood and how
most,
you think.
Most, if not all.
Because if you're getting ready to fight somebody, you're going to put on some Boosie, Tupac, whatever, yeah, you want to hear. Whatever type of chorus they're going to use is specific. If you want to listen to, if you type in sinister music, it's going, right, to be played a certain way. Like, those are the things, like, and I'm saying as a person who makes content, when I'm looking to do my intros, I'm looking for something, okay, this is suspenseful. This is, mm-hmm, going to be something people want to hear. It's, mm-hmm, going to bring people in this way. You have people seeing that. You have these people seeing these kids who ain't been raised by nobody the first thing they do instead of throwing a punch, they're shooting people.
Unfortunately, what you see is like a desensitizing and a normalization of certain media perpetuated by technology.
Yes.
Which was also one of the reasons I got into cyber. Just the more I learned about these products, that the more that I discovered that they were products, I know enough about our economy to know it's like, oh, okay, that's going to move in the interest of a corporation.
Yes.
Not in the interest of the people that they say they're serving. And as yourself, I'm a musician. So I actually did my graduate thesis for my MBA on the music industry. And I was working in the entertainment industry and fashion industry while I was in New York getting my MBA. And again, I'm that information girly. I'm intel. I'm going to be intel until I die, because it's like, wait, what did the Carfax say? Who is this impacting? Who is the target audience? Who is consuming this? Wow. Okay. When you understand like that, a lot of what is being produced is marketed towards younger and younger audiences, understandably, because those are some of the largest segments of our population. But also, what is the responsibility? Like, where does that lie as far as our society goes? And we know that, you know, people consider children to be the responsibility of their parents. And we understand that corporations have a responsibility to the shareholders. So it made me more centered on getting into security and getting into back-end technology, that I could have an understanding and at least at very least a responsible usage. And then most recently in my business, the ability to educate and make people aware, not just in a strictly cybersecurity perspective as far as processes that secure data and information, but how can you secure yourself when you use it, you know?
No, exactly. And while she's bringing up cybersecurity, I actually want to talk about today's sponsor, ECA, Ellington Cyber Academy. If you're looking to get into cybersecurity, they can definitely help you out with that. Here's some of the things that they can offer you. They have a partnership with Splunk and Sentinel One, detailed hands-on training designed for professionals who want to understand just beyond the service level for SIEM and SOAR. They specialize in SIEM and SOAR technology stacks such as Splunk, Splunk ES, XSOAR, etc. Nice. Also, you'll be able to be in the program until you reach your end goal of a new job, career, or a better salary. They're also partnered with my company for our career, resume, and coaching services. And you'll get access to industry-leading professionals and hiring managers. And check this out. Currently, they have a special going on. For the first three people who sign up for the month of May, will get $1,000 off their payment for the Cyber Career Boost program. So that's ECA Academy, and the link will be in the description. But it's so dope that that's the way and the angle that you're trying to do that. And that's why I like having guests of substance on this platform, because you don't really get much of that of all the people who ran to talk about tech or all these different things. Some of them are good, but nonetheless, most of them are copy and paste doing the same type of content.
Yeah.
And that's where I thrive, because I really, like you talk about musician, like former musician, but I also study content. I also look at the landscape on how to do stuff. And like, with my content, I'm not trying to reach everybody. This is only meant for certain people.
Yeah, it shows. It shows that you have that fit with your market. That's commendable. Most people don't even know that that's a thing. Most people that start businesses have no idea that they have to have a solid customer identified for them to truly be successful and not waste their money and time.
Right. Yeah, because like, you know, if you try to reach everybody, you'll reach no one.
Yeah, and even so, I had this conversation with someone else and I'm like, low-key, if everyone is digesting it, then it's probably something wrong with it. Like, you're doing something wrong if everybody agrees with you.
Right.
I really believe that.
Yeah, I like when people, you know, don't agree. Maybe I missed something, or maybe what you've been fed, you know, is not good.
Yeah.
We were talking before we even started recording about, like, talking about, like, your audience and doing the work, because you're trying to figure out which way you want to approach this.
Absolutely.
And that's the way I've always thought about approaching this, is like, I didn't want to make this based on people say, oh, that's the dude that got, which I don't have this, but if I wanted to, I can go rent a fancy car and trick you and make you think about getting a cyber is going to be this
guys,
a luxury thing, right? And there's only a subset of people that actually know who's did that, from like investing their money and really having a top, 1% skill set that offers them the six figures that don't start with a one.
Yeah.
So that's only for a certain subset of people.
And it still takes time to get there.
Yes.
To be very clear.
Exactly.
It does. I feel you.
Yeah. But a lot of people don't know. Like, I'm always, like I said, I like the people that rock with me because they know, hey, he just want us to, like, be able to get into the industry and thrive and not be trying to do fugazi stuff if they find out about them and then people get fired. Like, because that's why I like that with my audience. The stuff I say, if I come on here and just tell you, hey, get all these things and in 90 days you should be good, or telling people, oh yeah, this cert right here get you an entry level job. No, I'm very careful with my words because words mean something. And I just want y'all to be good overall.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I've enjoyed taking my time with it as well, because everyone's not meant to be in cybersecurity to begin with. Does that mean that you couldn't benefit from some level of employment therein? That doesn't mean that per se. So I took a step back, and even if you are meant to be in the space and you're super interested in it, the way that I did it may not be the way that you need to do it. So one of the first things I'm learning to share with people is that, hey, this is not prescriptive information. And a lot of people want prescriptive information. And that makes sense. I do too sometimes when I go to YouTube or when I go research and I'm like, just tell me how to do it. But you quickly realize that this information is not contextualized to you and your life. So one thing that also was important, similar to what you said, was, I mean, I've had a lot of businesses and they failed or they just weren't successful. They weren't sustained. And over time, what I realized was, and what I continued to realize was, it was the same question I asked people in business or in task, whatever it is, why are you doing this? And it's such a valid question that I continue to ask myself, because it could be because you want to do it. And in business, I've discovered that that's not a good enough reason to do something, because you're not in business to serve yourself. I'm sure that you don't do your business so that you can pay that Henri is going to be the key customer. That's not what we want. We're already paying for it. So if I expect someone else to find my services value, the first thing that I have to do is understand what they need.
Yeah.
And so I've been... One thing that made me continue to pursue my coaching business and this boutique consultancy and career coaching is people were coming to me to do that, and they were offering that. They were asking for something. They were paying for stuff. They were saying it would be cool if you do this. They were showing up for free things. They were showing up for things that were not so convenient for a working professional. When I started the webinar in July of last year, and I was doing live weekly webinars like 6 p.m. Central. And the fact that I could even have three working professionals, you know, 3 to 30 at any given evening, but even three, even one who was tired, just like me, who has responsibilities, kids, house, job, and still wanted to come get this information. That was proof of concept enough for me, but it was a proof of concept in a way that I've never experienced with any other type of business. So that let me know that there was a demand.
All right. So
alrighty,
you leave the military, and then that's when you work for Jeff Bezos.
Yes, that is when I work for Jeff Bezos. But I actually took 2 years to complete my undergraduate degree. So I went back to Howard, back to DC. And as soon as I graduated from Howard, I went back to New York. I was like, I'm going to do this all over again. I have the military behind me. I have the VA, the power of the VA with me. I can make it to New York. And so I was lucky enough to find a space there. I thought it was a sign from God, because I had a room in the Big L building. I don't know if you know who Big L is.
You talking about the rapper Big L?
The rapper Big L. So I moved into the Big L building in New York. I just thought that I'm a rapper, I'm a musician. I'm big mural of Big L, nice corner store, bodega. This is vibes. Central Harlem, kind of close to the Bronx. I think 139th, 140th. And I spent a year in New York. Got to live in Harlem and Brooklyn. I found a 1-year MBA program. I was still very energetic. I'm energetic now, but I was insane. I guess coming out of the Army, I was just bring it all on. 1-year MBA program. But there was a study abroad written into the program, so I was super excited. A week after enrolling in that program, hadn't even started, I got an offer from Amazon. So I had my job at Amazon through that year. So that also put the pressure on, but it was I got a job. I have to finish this thesis. I have to keep going. So that was just a godsend. a lot of people were like, you're going to regret working for Amazon. I do not regret working for Amazon, but it was a challenge. I was hired as an area manager. That's pretty much like a middle-level manager in a smaller fulfillment center. So I went directly into fulfillment operations. And yes, that does involve robots and the use of robotic tooling. But there are lots of people also involved. And that was one of my favorite parts of the job. A lot of associates that I had to manage, upwards of 300 people, rolling seasonally, temp, full-time, as well as managing managers. That was my first time doing that. But that really got me thinking about how can I remove myself physically from the workspace. That experience did. And it also made me like hands-on familiar with the way that machine data can be monitored and used to do predictive analytics and improve the quality of different situations. So
okay. So that really got you going down that machine learning deep dive?
Not too far into machine learning, but really, I would say definitely introducing me to data science in a real way, which does get there to machine learning being the way that we facilitate a lot of predictive analytics. It really got me thinking about dashboarding technology.
So we're like the Tableau.
Data-driven decision-making, Kibana. I didn't have as much time as I wanted to when I was working there. Being off the floor to do those projects. But I always look back and I say, okay, what would have made me incredibly successful in that position? And they have leadership principles. And one of them is invent and simplify. And mm-hmm. That was the one that I didn't do. I mean, I didn't do a lot of them, but that was the one that I wish I really took advantage of just because the sheer amount of data, right? That is available to me there and that I did see and just thought very critically about if I could do it all over again, what would make me a rock star? And that gave me the transferable skill, the most recent or immediate transferable skill and kind of perspective. A lot of people think you have to have this rock solid transferable skill when you're getting into cybersecurity. The first thing you need is the perspective. That'll get you further than a lot of people think. I think I just came across a CISSP prep course and I just perused it very shortly, and that's one of people's key takeaways for that professional certification exam is a perspective. Like, and I think that's probably why I excel at most things that I do, because I kind of have that military on me. Like, you get dropped in a situation, you have to immediately look around, see what's going on, and adapt and kind of turn on that present vision and say, okay, what are the materials, what do I have at my disposal, and how can I work that thing to make myself invaluable?
No, I agree. And when you were talking, I thought about, well, for one, you said though those principles, which is that whole interview process is. Yeah, that's all I'm gonna say about the interview process.
It's funny because having done it once successfully, I think back like what kind of state, like what perspective was I in when I interviewed so well for this, you know, it's grueling, but I think at the time, possibly coming out of that military work, I had a predisposition for what they were looking for. In practice, it's not who I am
right
as a person, so it didn't work out long-term for me.
Yeah. But, I know, like, even for me, like, when I did my latest, and I'm saying latest, this is like last year, I went back and listened to it, and I was like, shouldn't have said that.
Yeah, you got to keep a tight shot group. The STAR method is a real thing. Mm-hmm. So it definitely got, you know, there's so many lessons learned, right? So like, again, it could be that space was not for me long term. Didn't necessarily enjoy it. Didn't have the best balance, but so many great learning.
Yeah.
So much great learning that I did there that I can take with me into so many other different experiences is important to me. So yeah, the leadership principles are cheesy, but as a communicator and as a writer myself, it's invaluable for you to be able, and I tell people this all the time too, you want to make yourself invaluable in a corporation, draw a straight line between what you want to do for your individual contributor goals and the strategic objectives of that corporation, and you will not miss.
Yeah.
Can't miss.
Yeah. And I was happy that you put in, you said something about the CISSP. Like, I actually have finally put my foot forward and I'm actually consistent with the studying of it. I had another friend, she was talking about she's taking it. I said, look, keep me accountable. because I get so busy. But I was like, I'm using WizLab, so I got the WizLab on my phone. So, you know, I can do like the domains. Like, I know some of the domains that I got to book the study to. So I know, kind of know about
but the accountability partnership is everything. Yeah. That's kind of what I offer. Like, that's essentially what my competitive advantage is. It's like, you need somebody that's going to kind of be on your ass, but like, is in it with you too?
Oh, yeah. That's me. I'm telling straight up. I'm like, what are you doing? Don't
what
be
are
waiting.
We doing?
Like, sometimes my clients are like, you know, waiting on me too long. Like, if I'm giving them a recruiter's info or something like that, they're like trying to message me and ask me, well, what should I do? And sometimes, like, you just got to go for it sometimes.
Yes.
Trial and error and figure out they respond. If they don't, hey, it is what it is. Because sometimes if I'm dealing with real life working and trying to give it to y'all, sometimes I will not get back to y'all as fast as I want to. I mean,
that's life.
If you really need me, email me or text me like I tell them to.
And then have things, and just to caveat that really quickly, because we're going to have a laugh about this, about some email contact, but have an action plan. Have something actionable for the professional that you are reaching out to. Think about it, like, if this was your one time, your one conversation that you had with this person, is this enough for them to really make an astute determination of, can they give you what you're asking them for? Are you asking them for anything? So, like, I really take that one-shot mentality. Like, if you were in the elevator with, you know, Sam Altman, I don't know, like, this is your one shot. You don't know if you're going to encounter this person again. Make it count. Yeah. And I feel that way about email, too.
Come on, Eminem.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm not a big Eminem fan, but I get
I'm
it.
Not either,
I know
but
that
you
song.
Just said that's how I was laughing
you
at. I think
lose
like,
yourself.
And I still think about Terrence Crawford when he beat up Errol Spence. But, and you brought up the CISSP for something that another director that I befriended and it was actually pretty smart. She was saying how, like, so right now, one of the advices I give people sometimes, they don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
I do say, go check out that Coursera course because it gets you all the domains. It simplifies it for you. Kind of gives you enough information to figure out what domain you may want to specialize in.
Yeah.
And she was like, you know, another thing people can do is just they can go look at the domains for the CISSP.
That and other professional certifications. That is, so for me, I start people with the foundational knowledge that they need to pass Security Plus because it's instrumental first step in. If you know nothing about cybersecurity and you start with the learning the domains and passing the CompTIA Security Plus, you're fairly equipped to move on to something that is either vendor specified, domain specified. I would even argue you're kind of prepared to do project work and start getting some hands-on training at that point. Even if you don't choose to sit for it, the fact that these certifications such as CISSP and the CompTIA suite of applications certifications are recognized, right, by major corporations, by DOD. And again, maybe I have that military bias, but
it's the military bias.
It's a bias, but it is also the knowledge of if this is good enough, right, for the people who protect the life and the well-being and our interest abroad, then it's good enough for private sector. And that's what I know about the standardization mechisms that are in place with
DOD. I really don't think it's the fact, not to say it's not good enough, but I honestly just think it's because it's big business between
And that. I don't think risk analysis wise that we sacrifice a detrimental degree of quality because that business relationship.
No, it's not. But I'm just saying, like, sometimes that's the red tape on stuff when we've encountered individuals who have said certifications who don't know much.
Oh, that's going to happen. This is not, again, none of this is prescriptive.
Right.
None of this is a one size fits all. None of this is a guaranteed. None of this is a one stop shop. These are just pathways and entry points and opportunities that someone could use to potentially find their way. Because again, you could get started, you could ace all of those exams and decide that you want nothing to do with cybersecurity.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why I'm not heavy on a lot of certs early on. I'll say, okay, you want to get Security Plus, cool. I specifically say, if you want to do government work, like go ahead and get them government type of CompTIA certifications, because of course you're not going to get past stuff without having it because they're going to be requirements.
Mm-hmm.
But other people, I may say, get something that's like foundational. I also endorse Josh Matacor's Level Careers course because it gives them some hands-on skills.
Mm-hmm.
And in the private sector, like, what you have, it's a whole different type of like clusterfuck. You have mm-hmm. people, hiring managers that actually just want some people that's passionate and they'll bring them in. Mm-hmm. Then you got the people who they might have a lean team. They don't really have time to really train anybody. Mm-hmm. So they're looking for somebody that's either did some labs or has some hands-on experience mm-hmm. and can answer some of their scenario hypothetical questions.
Yes.
And so you do, like you said, it's not a one-size-fit-all thing.
But I do think that regardless of the path that you take, that level of requirement of being qualified is that level.
No, I agree.
Yeah, I sit with people who have no degrees.
Mm-hmm,
and I have a liberal arts degree, but I have a degree. I sit with people who have none. I sit with people who have no professional certifications.
Right.
I sit with people who have tons of them that personally, you know, myself or my manager don't really care about necessarily. So it really becomes about, to your point, like, can you do the work and can you communicate that you can do the work?
Right.
And ultimately, that's what it comes down to. But I would never advise someone to try to shoot from the hip if they're really trying to be strategic about what they're doing, which is why I do lean a bit towards the professional certifications. And not that you have to, like, I don't recommend people get A+, Network+, Security+. I do not recommend that. If you're going to do anything, I recommend you start at Security+, because it will comprehensively say, even if you fall short of cybersecurity, you're going to get a service desk, you're going to get a IT help. So, you know, you can
I just actually made a video hireably. On that. And it was mm-hmm. about, of course, it was sponsored by Course Careers, but they did have an IT course.
Okay, yeah.
And I'm like, hey, if you want a job immediately and you want to actually have someone on your resume,
amen,
do this course, because A+ is just going to be a test. It's not going to show you much. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is not. But this one, and they're using Azure. They're setting stuff up in AD. Mm-hmm. So they're actually doing things. So if you do apply to a service as a mm-hmm. help desk, you can get an entry-level role. And then that's how you figure out, when you're in a help desk, you see all these tickets getting routed. You can go mm-hmm. talk to them people that's fixing the incidents to figure out what you want to do. It's like a cheaper route.
Absolutely.
And so that's why if I say, okay, if your immediate goal is that you just want to get an IT job now, mm-hmm. let's do this, I would skip the A+, because it's still not, to me, it's still not up to par with what they should be focusing on. And I mm-hmm. think it's too expensive.
Yeah, price point. I think price point, a lot of people get priced out of the career because of the examinations. And we talking about CompTIA, several hundred dollars max, right? But, you know, us, we're like, sans.
Oh, yeah.
Please help. You know, you're pricing good, educated, experienced folks out, right? So I agree with that totally. But I do think there's a lot of available resources and content that do come with the examination. So like, you can finesse it. Like, me personally, I don't teach any professional certification without labs. So while I don't necessarily advise most of my students sit for CompTIA A+, unless you really feel like you need to, because again, this is your choice, there are still labs offered with CompTIA A+.
It was a guy, and I'm in this black IT group on Facebook. Mm-hmm. He asked the group about, it's a guy or woman, they're about to pay $4,000 to do some A+, some boot camp. I was like, that's a waste of money.
Well, and then a lot of boot camps are overpriced now. We got to look at how cheap knowledge is becoming. Like, I just hate to be a nerd, but
yeah, for certain things, I don't think so, because it's like I said, that's not really showing you nothing. Now, if you're mm-hmm. getting a specialized skill set mm-hmm. and they have it set up in a way professional, they're connecting you with different hiring. Like, it goes into the part, like, when I tell people, when you were coming to work with me, it's not just, you know, you're working with me and I'm doing stuff. Now, if you're in my network, like, I had a guy that wanted to go into Threat Intel. I connected somebody with Threat Intel. So if it's other things, okay, you want to do detection engineering? Okay, cool. My friend right here does detection engineering. Oh, you want to do IR? Cool. Oh, you want to do DLP? I got somebody. Like, so is now, outside of what the stuff I'm showing you, now I can connect you directly to a person who can show you what they're doing day to day. And those are some of the things, like, when we're growing up, I was feeling out people are paying these monies for getting these certain rooms. Mm-hmm. That's sometimes the thing that you got to look at long term, is like just being connected to somebody, the degrees of separation between you and somebody else that could actually help you.
Yeah.
Pretty much probably get that dream job or whatever you want to do in your career.
One thing that's we all probably take for granted that is of great importance is our network. Because, I mean, even in building a new, I wouldn't have my job if I wasn't literally actively building a new network. I had COVID and I went to a virtual conference. Like, that's the only reason I have my job. Turned that camera on, introduced myself, and the ball gets rolling to two or three other people that I don't even know.
Let's talk about that, because that was my next question. It's like,
yeah,
you go from, you said you did get laid off at Amazon, right? Because of COVID.
I got laid off at I got laid off from Amazon during COVID. I went through a role switch. When COVID occurred, I was actually, I had just got a promotion, mm-hmm. but the promotion was an international promotion. And there's a lot of politics in these companies, and I was not able to secure a promotion stateside, interestingly enough. But lo and behold, I went above and beyond, as we do, and I got a promotion to a building in Spain. So I had to brush up on my Spanish. I had to be extraordinary, okay, just to get operations manager, having already done that job to launch a building, mind you. So I was like, okay, at least I'll get to live in Spain. You know, this will be another opportunity, you know, for me to decide what my growth with the company is and so on and so forth. Then COVID happens. And so like the visa process is just, no one knows what's going on at that time. It was also a time of great unrest. I mean, this is at the time of the death of George Floyd. I was living in Baltimore. It was a really contentious like time. Summer of 2020, like super contentious. I went through a role change in which I was doing COVID related work, in a sense of spatial dynamics of a building. And I was just like, you know, this is not really working for me. So I left the company. And I really wanted to sit back and take the time to be able to understand what I wanted to do next. I didn't want to get pushed into the same thing. I didn't want to, out of desperation or need for money, to just hop into something that I knew again was not suited for me. I won't say I took the L, but I took some intentional L's. Like
I don't think it's an L. I think it's a lesson.
I mean, yeah. It's, 100% lesson and blessing. I moved back in with my parents in D.C. Because I wanted to be closer to them during this crisis. And that was a hard decision. And it was hard to live through as well. But like, again, a lesson and a blessing, because how long do we have our parents, you know? Mm-hmm. And then to actually just kind of grow through that COVID process with your parents is also major, because a lot of people couldn't even see their parents. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, couldn't be around your parents, because a lot of our, you know, they have immunocompromise or, you know, comorbidities or something, because it was like dangerous. Like, yeah. It was very dangerous.
Because my parents, they end up getting it in, what was that? Late 2020 or either 2021. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was definitely a different time.
Yeah. Our elders had a bad bout with COVID, like a significant amount of loss of life in a specific segment of our Black and brown population. It was important for me to have that moment to just like get back to the basics of, dang, like what do I want to do with my life and my career, like having all of these at that point different experiences. So I ended up finding a VA program. It was called Vet Tech, and it was in a pilot, and it's no longer even a thing. And they, outside of your post 9/11 GI Bill, which is the primary education fund, they did additional funding to train veterans in in-demand fields. Mm-hmm. And so they have everything from software engineering, machine learning, artificial intelligence. And I'm a researcher, true and true. So I was like, let me go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Okay. Key, the Bureau of Labor Statistics. I don't care what the news is writing about jobs. I don't care what the politics with Joe Biden, with Trump. I don't care what nobody say about the jobs. You go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it will give you detailed information on what industries, what sectors, what roles, what jobs are hiring, how fast they're growing against the totality of U.S. occupations, right? So when I looked at software engineering and software development, you know, it's growing quite fast over the 5-year period that I was looking at it. But the number of developers in the millions in the U.S. And then I looked at information security, because the way they codify this is different. You know, rose by any other name would smell as sweet. Not the perfect codification, but let's go information security as opposed to cybersecurity. Right. Hundreds of thousands. So immediately what that told me was that
supply
and demand. Exactly. We are making things exponentially faster than we are securing them. And so what you know about about demand is that, okay, I want to be in the shallower pool. Like I want to be in the less crowded space, because that means I'll be a little bit more coveted and I'll be a little bit more indispensable. That was my logic. And so I started to pursue it. And immediately when I started to learn it, people that I was talking to and networking with, I was working at a cigar bar in DC, and a lot of those patrons were GovTech employees working in cybersecurity. So it was a lot of like difficult but very strategic decisions that I made to put myself in these spaces. And so I'm just like studying my tail away, like slinging drinks, you know, and cigar smoke, you know, being nosy and just networking and stuff like that. And
in there with the sugar daddies.
In there with the sugar daddies. Like, what you do for a living? Like, you do what? Oh, I'm studying for this. They're like, oh, yeah, really? Like, they're like, whatever. Like, they think I'm going to be there. I wasn't there, baby, after 90 days. 90 days, folks. And so I was studying. I took CompTIA Security Plus in 30 days. Like, I was studying 16 hours a week. Like, mm-hmm. my weekends were spent in a class. So, on the one hand, every boot camp is not created equal. But what... Again, strategy. I chose a boot camp that did not get their money until I got hired. They don't get paid until Tiffany gets hired. That was important to me.
Yeah, so they're incentivized to get you hired.
Okay. So I'm gonna get hired, essentially, at the end of the day. That's what that means to me. They're not going to continue to offer this service unless they know they have something good, right? They have a short shot program. So I took CompTIA Security Plus in June of 2021. And then I followed up immediately, certified ethical hacking. Which is very easy after taking CompTIA Security Plus.
It's easy anyway.
Okay, well.
I hate that test.
CEH, it's super easy.
I hate it because I took it when they changed what I had just studied. And oh. All the questions that I took the test on back in 2015? Oh. All of them were different.
Not on exam.
Yeah.
Reworded
and I should have just protested it to see if I could like retake it. Because everybody was saying the same thing on Reddit. It was like, yo, this is
And you just not never retook studied. It?
Yeah, I was done with it. Back, it was expensive. That was $500 for me, and I was doing help desk at the time.
So expensive, and CH is way more expensive than that now. It's like a couple. It's like thousands of dollars.
Right, and back then, all you really had to do was know what different MAP scans were.
I mean, pretty much. I mean, the domains of, but this is why I don't shot. This is why I gravitate towards the subject matter that the test covers, because it's right. going to be like, if you can say you have command of all five of Security Plus domains, and you learn how to speak to that, and you actually get some hands-on training with that. You're good. You're so doing better than most.
So in 2013, like you, I was working at Target. It was in between me finna go to my last quarter in undergrad. I got my Security Plus. Mm-hmm. I just did it off of studying the book. My CD for the hands-on didn't work.
Dang.
So it wasn't, I mean, outside of me, I took like a forensics class, undergrad, stuff like that, but know nothing.
And a lot of people feel that way, but I think my experience was so different, but it's also, again, in the context of
Because you was being strategic.
Yes.
I was not, somebody.
I still have my physical notebook for CompTIA Security Plus, and it's that work.
It's somewhere in my parents' crib. But.
And having went straight into IR, AppSec, SSDOC, it is valid.
No, yeah, because you literally got to see the stuff that they were kind of talking about. Mm-hmm. For me, I saw some of the stuff because I did help desk for TSA.
Okay.
But at the same time, it was just like, that's what I'm saying. That's why this is like a good, you know, back and forth banter.
For sure.
Because the guy at the time was like, retired Air Force, had a military job on the base in Bossier. Mm-hmm. It was like, yo, you should get this. Mm-hmm. But then it's like, a lot of people, when I had my consultations, I got all these certs, but I can't get hired. And I was like, yeah, because you weren't strategic and you didn't really learn anything or know what you wanted to do. They just told you to get the certification.
Yeah, which is and that is, it's not this industry. That's important for people to understand. And then I like to start at a baseline of, you know, the person who secured your organs. Did they just go study an exam and just sit for an exam? No. So why all of that heat in your phone? Why should the person who secures all of that stuff you got in your phone just go sit? You like, is that appropriate? Even as the person who seeks to do that, you know, I think in our desperation just to keep it a buck, like we need it now. But the reality of the situation is like that's not how we're going to get anything of quality, whether that's a cybersecurity career or anything else. Like that's not how you get things of quality. And so if you want to be truly competitive and you want to have a leg to stand on and go into a place and speak confidently and say, no, I was not hired to do this already, but this is everything that I've been doing on my own, you can do that. Like I did the same thing. I didn't finish OWASP WebGoat, but I was damn sure struggling through it enough to speak to any hiring manager about what it is that I'm bumbling through. That was the first thing I did. I was doing Security Plus and OWASP WebGoat. So I at least did what? I had to troubleshoot to implement this software, right? And so every step of the way, I'm like, oh, nah, this is blowing me. But why is it blowing me? You know, da, da, da. Like, so I'm very strategic in that manner. And I encourage my students to do that. But it, again, that is what's pushing me in this consultancy, in this coaching practice, because it really becomes about mindset. Like, before you even can get into what to tell somebody what a tool is, they have to believe that they can learn something different and change that perspective.
Exactly. Exactly. And we'll touch on that, because you're talking about some things that I tell people all the time. Like, it kills me not when I have my clients record their interviews. So when I'm listening to them, I'm like, see, I'm in mind when they ask them questions. I told you they was going to ask you this. I said, I ain't just making it up. I just know most of these hirings got the same thing, especially for people who don't have that much experience. They're trying to really gauge how interested you are in the field or what's going to separate you from these other 1,000 people that applied. Mm-hmm. So you get your first, well, you already had a big girl job, but we're going to say your first.
Right. I'm an enterprise girl.
Right. We're going to say this is your big
cyber job,
corporate cyber job.
Yeah.
How was that transition for you being on, you know, first of all, you know what? This is our second, let's see, shout out to Xavier. I want to say it's like our second red teamer here. Blue or red?
For me, red side. I personally consider myself purple through and through. I do.
Yeah.
Because I'm a dual. I have a lot of duality naturally, and you can't have one without the other. If you want a robust solution, and I also am super anti SPOF, single points of failure. Like, I'm a comprehensive girly. I'm a strategic girl. Like, I know that I'm going upward and not staying in the IC. So purple for me, but red if I had to pick. And you know, having started out blue, that was exhaustive for me. Anytime in any space that I just have to react, like if the basis of my life is reacting, I'm probably more overwhelmed than I feel like I should be.
Right. And like, you know what's funny about that? It depends, because you can be proactive, reactive.
Oh, as you should be. But as an IC, like, and you're working blue, you will have to react
something. I think through different experiences, you see different postures and you figure
for
out.
For sure.
You figure out who's like, that's the funny thing too, is like when you like worked at certain companies and you're just looking at these, like, I know the key to the kingdom and where the body's buried. Like,
oh, that's the best thing. Like, my first week was Log4j and I was on the application security.
Yeah, you had a lot of fun. Thing.
I was the only team member hired. Like, it was my hiring manager who was in Foster City, California, and it was me and Austin during Log4j.
Yeah, you had fun. And see, I was working at, and I had just gotten to finance when mm-hmm. Log4j happened, but they kept me on the sidelines. So I was doing incident management at the time. So I was like, I was mad because I want to like put me in, because another reason why I like the blue team, when I play football, defense, I love playing defense because right. I know I can stop you from scoring and I can score too. So I like that because it's, you know, aggressive in nature. But
I think I immediately, like, I'm always like, I need to see under the rug. Mm-hmm. Because as it started out, right, as a defensive operation for me, my tasks are defensive, or just sitting on that bridge and just hearing every single thing that we were doing to stop the bleeding. Then it became really quickly about, almost immediately about how deeply are we impacted?
Mm-hmm.
And to understand how deeply, in what ways and who, whether what products are or are not impacted, you have to look backwards into the design, into the architecture. Mm-hmm. Then you're getting into, before even bill of materials, you're getting into the supply chain and the enterprise ecosystem. And you're like, this is deep. Like it's so deep. And like, so I became intrigued with that. And the deeper I went, I was like, well, it has to start at the beginning, right? It has to start at product conceptualization. You have to have a defensive design perspective, even if you will. You have to assume that these things are going to happen, right? And so you have to make the product like that from the jump. And we just know that that's not how.
That's the last thing in mind.
Last thing in mind.
A lot of times in interviews, I've always said, like, you kind of got to assume like you already been like compromised some type of way.
You have to, because so, you have.
Yeah. And you just never know. They might just haven't made their move yet. But no, I mean, right. And also the good thing too about like if you do an IR or something like that, and it's big incidents, you start getting to see all the heads of all the different
orgs. Baby, I cleaned up. I'm not gonna claim that I'm annoying, but it probably appeared to be annoying to some who didn't get tapped on their shoulder by me, because if I sit on a bridge with you and you're kicking ass and it's my first week, I immediately am emailing you, hey, I just need 15. I will find 15 minutes on somebody that is located in the UK. I don't care. I was on everybody's top.
Yeah.
And one thing that I benefited from, like, yes, it was a frying pan into the fire situation, but because I was the only one on that team, my manager at the time was a senior director. So I'm on a bridge with a CTO and a CISO. Everybody that I'm reaching out
visibility.
To. Visibility. Immediately. Because if I know nothing else, I could know nothing about what you're talking about. I'm a great question asker. So I'm good at seeing the gap, the in-between that's not being answered, and the failure points of what has already happened. So I got the opportunity to put together our point of view documentation, which would have had a regulatory audience of to say, what did we do when this happened? Like in totality as a cybersecurity.
Yeah. And so this is, and we'll actually talk about some technical things in a second, but this is when I start talking to the people about all those non-technical transferable skills that you can use, because believe it or not, like you're talking about communication, those people, those C-levels, those directors, when these incidents popping up, they want to see that summary of what's going on. How are we impacted? What are we doing? How big is it? And it needs to be written in a way, like you said, that makes sense, that sounds good.
Yeah. Even the wherewithal to know, or to have the confidence or gumption to know when to schedule a meeting to discuss it, when not to, when to send an email, how to present that information, who should be involved, who shouldn't. I had someone use my communication skills as a negative when referring to me. And that was probably one of the best things that happened to me when I started my technical career, because it made me confronted. And at first I was like, no, I'm not. Like, I am technical. I have done this. I have done that. I deserve to be here. And while I did, it took me a minute to be like, oh, wow, like, your superpower is your superpower. And how can any information or knowledge be transferred without communication? I'll wait. Mm-hmm. And then I thought about it again. I'm like, well, if it's something that you all can't do, admittedly, why would I be ashamed to have that skill, regardless of their intent? Yeah. If you can't do it, right? And anybody can pick up a application documentation and figure it out, especially now with chat and all of these tools, and help from somebody else. What's very difficult to do is teach an adult how to be a comfortable communicator, non-verbally and verbally, in enterprise level communications at that level of substance.
Yeah, I see it all the time. I see the people, and believe it or not, this has helped me very much do that.
I believe that, yeah.
If I have to brief something or get my thoughts together and not saying a lot of ums and oohs and your nose, like knowing what I wrote and saying it, it's fine. Or even the times where, you know, the good thing is if I'm typing up an incident, I'm typically letting, you know, my manager see it, like, what you think?
QA is good for you.
He's like, yeah, it sounds good. You know, let's send it out. Mm-hmm. Those things. So that's cool. But let's give the watchers some sense. Something as far as when you were on the blue side, right? Mm-hmm. And you said you're doing incident response, mm-hmm. but specifically app security, right?
Yes.
Can you, in so many like a short form words, like kind of explain that? And then I guess what that consisted of, and then I guess what would like be some skill sets people would need to know how to do that?
For sure. So I want to keep it simple. Okay, let's say that you have a product, you have a tech product, and it's made up of a host of different parts, right? You have components, you have programming languages, you have libraries, and some of those libraries, let's refer to them as dependencies, because they may not be the main part of your application, but they're really supporting your application, and they have made it easier for you to get this product to market as a developer, because you don't have to say ABC, this class, that class, this class. You can import that library in and you can get that functionality, right? And just as an aside, it does make use of application programming interfaces. So that is one of the levels of API integrations in a development stack. So sometimes people look at products as a whole. However, security incidents and vulnerabilities can happen at the most granular levels, right, of a product, meaning some small dependency, some small component part that you're not even checking for in your product, it has some type of point of failure. What are we talking about? That could be as simple as the way that this functionality is written as a class, as far as programming languages goes. That class may be implemented in a way that allows a user or somebody that is inputting information or data into the application to make it behave in a way that it's not intended to. That does not necessarily mean that that's malicious intent, right? However, once it is discovered that if you put a space, and this is completely hypothetical, if you put a space after this class, or if you change a configuration of a specific class to say on when it should say off, you can then connect to it through some type of remote connection protocol or whatever, or it will lead to a pathway into the deepest recesses of that application, remote code execution. That is some of the subject matter of some of the worst vulnerabilities that affect applications, specifically web applications made up of programming languages and dependency libraries, specifically open source libraries. What's an open source library? Java. That's in everything, right? And that's when we talk about Log4j, that is what we're talking about. We're talking about something that is so prevalent, that is so ubiquitous in these digital products, that it is a 5-alarm fire when it is found out, especially when it's made public, when it's made public, right? Because at first it wasn't malicious, just the fact that it exists, right? But when we make it public, that opens up the door and it gives those who could be, would be malicious, the opportunity to use that, right, for malicious intent to then, you know, bypass some of our other security protocols using these, essentially these back doors or these openings in the programming language, right? So as an application security engineer and an incident responder, our jobs with the use, and it's really complicated because we have AppSec engineers, but each of us are doing different stuff, right? We have people that work in the SOC that are doing firewall. We have intrusion detection. We have signature malware analysis. We have, we have so much stuff. I wish I could just like give all of it away right now, but there's a lot of us. So me, I got to connect the dots between the person who recognized in Splunk or other technology that, hey, this looks off, this traffic looks a little bit different, or we have an advisory that there is a 0 day in this program. Mm-hmm. Then I go look at all of the products that a company has and I say, which one has this component? Mm-hmm. And that's when it gets deep, because that's when it's like, how clean is your house? Because how do we know what it's made of? Let's say it, what's it called? Red 8? What's the name of that food coloring that's really bad? Red something, red 9, a food coloring that's really bad. Is there a body, right, in our dietary products or industry, in our dietary industry, in our food industry, that says, I have a repository and I have a list of every single product that we eat that has this red dye in it that we now know is poisonous to us? We don't. And most tech companies don't have this to the degree that they need to. I mean, how many of us have it? If we were like, oh, there's XYZ in this type of dye, how could we just, you know, get that information? So 9 times out of 10, that becomes a really complicated thing. And so as an AppSec incident responder, it was my job to bridge the gap between understanding the elements, okay? The elements of a vulnerability, okay? You need A, you need B, and you need C. And then I would go into the products and say, do you have A? Do you have B? Do you have C? And it's not enough for them to say, no, I don't know. Yes. Like, we have to have technological ways of validating a tech stack. And when it comes to the programming language, that can be pretty simple because that's a static code analysis, right? So let's say in the case of Log4j, patch to the next Java, and then the next day, the next Java, and then the next day, the next Java, right? And so that could be as simple as validating a code scan. And it's that we call that static code analysis, or if you ever hear anything like SAST, because there's programs that we've abstracted away, thank God. And you can get down into the weeds of it, and you should at a certain degree, but that will be on the product side where we say, this is the space in the code. This is what we need to look at, and we can run that through an automation and say, is it there? It gets even trickier, which is why I like being on the red side of things, when you need to dynamically test something to find if the vulnerability is still actually a thing in this product. What does that mean? Okay, as opposed to looking at the words in a dictionary, you need to look at how it's used in a sentence.
Yeah.
And that would be the key. That would be a good way to understand the difference between SAST and DAST with static code, static application security testing and dynamic application security testing. So that's what kind of pushed me into that realm where it's like, well, this is kind of boring. Like just looking at the static code analysis and checking a box, because what if when they do the next build, are they going to revert to the feature change? So it's like, how do we? And so it just made my, like, I got really excited at that point, because I'm like, I'm not the police, but like, I'm the police. Like, what are you doing? Like, prove it. I'm a very much like a prove it person. And again, that's that intelligence, that military in me. It's like, well, how do you know that? And so I had that natural propensity. And so once we decide, okay, you are impacted, have you patched it? How do we attest to the change? Is it a static check? Is it a dynamic check? Is it both? Okay, when we talk about security assessments, your security assessment is going to bring in that and a lot of other things. You're going to have some GRC people, if you guys heard of governance, risk, and compliance, they're going to say, well, this is publicly knowledgeable. So based upon our relationship with these governments and our ability to do good business and trusted business, we got to have this taken care of within this amount of time, because this is the risk associated with this. And risk has to do with monetary calculations of having something offline, but also the likelihood of this being taken advantage of and what it would mean if it was. So you got that calculation in there. You have corporate communications in there. And then you have the whole back end of the changes still going on. So once it's determined that those things are all met, it's all tidy, we're unaffected, we're cleaned up. I am also reporting that to senior management. Who is that? That's the CTO. That's the CISO, right? They have it is incapable for them to get as granular with that information. They cannot review personally at the CISO level, 7,000 plus applications to determine it. You got to learn how to make a pivot chart. So when people talk about soft skills and things of that nature, come on, Excel is not dead. Okay. Dang. People just,
scared. I used it a lot when I was doing my data analytics role.
And you, as you should, because it's still good. And there's a lot there that you can learn. And they've even implemented a lot of emerging technologies to make it easier to use. Mm-hmm. But there are also other data analytics tools that you can use. But in the heat of the night, there's nothing like Excel and a pivot chart to say, externally hosted, you know, internally hosted, pivot that thing out. Okay. So once those pivot charts are made, we're briefing and we're continuing every day, something like three times a day.
Yeah.
And
that's depending on the scope of the incident.
That's just our time zone. Mind you, this is happening across the globe. This is an international global enterprise. We have products, services, customers all over the world. So we're checking back in. We're saying, did you patch? Did you patch? You know, even determining how those product teams, I wrote a communications plan for our incident response team. How do I expect us to communicate to you and you to communicate to us about this? Because that becomes almost developer advocacy.
And that's where you're getting into communication.
Absolutely.
To where these people are saying, hey, our team, this is our incident, we're running it, and we know you guys are going to contact us this type of way.
Yes. It's super important so that you don't, I mean, noise, you know, techno stress and noise is a real thing. How do you get the, and that's, it comes to experience. And at the same time, people can become entrenched and take things for granted. So I think you do have to have that consistent vigilance too, because we want to not over alert you, but we want to be able to tell you when it's something that you should know within a timely manner. And when it comes to things like Wednesday is basically Friday to me. Because if I know something is has a high severity, I got to let you know immediately, even on the red side, like that's good communication to your point. But it's also about relationship building, because it's like, if this might put them in a position where they're going to have somebody do overtime, or someone might have to be there on a weekend or after hours just to get that done. So it doesn't have to go to exception. Exception has to do with the risk tolerance of the company or the product, meaning we agreed that you would have this fixed by this. There's no risk. But if it's going to go beyond that, you then have to appeal to another body of in your corporation. And this is a huge deal for products, because every minute that you're not reaching your customer with your product, it's taking a hit and you're losing money. Okay. This is a business implication. There goes the business business implication. People don't understand that about cybersecurity. This is a relationship about business, risk, and technology.
Yeah. That was whatever CSSP stuff I've been listening to, Mind Map on YouTube. It's like, people have to realize, because you want to post this, when you say perspective mm-hmm. or mindset mm-hmm. of a manager, it's like we're enabling the business to continue to make money.
I'm hoping that CISSP will be easy for me because I have the business background.
Let's all do it. Everybody do it. Let's do it together.
I really want burp. I want a burp, sir. I want all this crazy hands-on IC, but I'm always balancing against like having a, like I'm trusting the comprehensiveness of my skill set, right, and wanting to like honoring that, okay, I put enough time in to develop a unique career path, as we all should. We should, but we don't always enjoy, right, the comfort to do that. And I'm just thankful to God that I can now say, okay, I want to do something that doesn't look like what my manager did, or, and I have the opportunity to do that. But
right,
that's what it gave me, you know?
So going from blue to red,
yeah,
how were you able to do that? Because, you know, I have so many people, they reach out to me like, oh, I want to be on the red team. Yeah. I want to be on the red team. And I'm like, okay, well, what you know how to do?
It was a mix of a lot of things. It was like a better culture fit for me. I think, just to be very honest with you, I was in a situation where I had to stand up for myself and my growth and my development.
Gotcha.
I was new to the company. I was experiencing some things that were not pleasant. And I was trying to figure out, okay, what's my next step? Because I was hired with the understanding that, okay, this is your first in. You will get your bearing straight and you can decide what you want to do next. And people say that in these companies. So I didn't trust it at first, right, to be honest with you. It's like, oh, you know, I don't know how fluid the movement is. Everyone wants you to believe that you can move around and you can try new things, but I had not experienced that until this point. So I was continuously internally networking. I was talking. I can't help but talk. I get nervous. I talk. I'm sad. I talk. Like, mm-hmm. I be talking jab. So I was just talking to a lot of different people, and I was actually working on a project. I was working on a bug bounty project. And bug bounties have high severities because they mm-hmm. use ethical hackers to a degree, or black hat, kind of gray hat, hackers that are external to an enterprise or a network to find vulnerabilities at the perimeter of a application. So that's at the internet facing, as we call it, facing the public internet. And I was dealing with these incidents, and I was like, we're driving this program, you know, globally. I was calling product leads like, hey, you had an IDOR, you know, it's like last month, it's closed. The security assessment closed. They're like, I don't see no security assessment, you know? And I'm like, no, this is about the root cause, you know? And so people were kind of flippant. It just wasn't the fire, you know, and to the point about knowing when to reach out to people. And so I had that IR experience, and I'm doing this side project. I'm like, I need to have more impact. You know, I want to be there before that this is closed, because once it's closed, again, you in cybersecurity, you hear something called shift left, and that should always be the position that you want to be in, because again, it's way more expensive to fix something after it's already made than it is when it's not completely made. You should try to be doing that iterative improvement, mm-hmm. just like us, right? So I was doing a bug bounty feedback loop analysis, so to call it. And I really wanted to get in on the action, and I wanted something that had a more growth potential for me.
Right.
And so not having a formal computer science background, I pretty much knew that the best way, I just had to get under the hood, so to speak. And so the only way to really get under the hood without going to the development team, which I was not interested in, was to go red, because we are the ones, now that I understand it now, that works very closely with the product team to understand how they think their application should work, and then I get to prove them wrong.
Right.
And so what that entails is understanding the application on a whole new level. Yep. Like I saw this coworker, and she just looked at me like I was such a geek, and I was like, I just want to walk through the application. And she was like, what are you talking about? But I'm like, if you conceptualize it that way, authentication schemas make a lot more sense to you when you think about types of doorbells, when you think about types of identification in a physical sense.
Yeah.
If I was to walk into this room, how do I get in here?
I'm glad you brought that up. I was having a consultation with a guy, and I think he was talking about wanting to be on the blue team or red mm-hmm. team or whatever. I think it was blue team, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so initially when I said, I think I asked him somebody like, what would you do? Like, you responded to an alert and somebody's account been compromised, like, mm-hmm. or an unusual authentication or something like that, mm-hmm. anything. But I was like, you know, what would you check for? And he was like, I don't know. So I was like, all right, let's say you come home
right.
and you see the lights are on and your door is open. Right. What are you going to do when you walk in the house? And then he started naming stuff you do.
Exactly.
I was like, it's a similar thing on the network.
It is.
You're going to go look for these kind of certain things that people typically see.
It is.
When a compromise is taking place.
I mean, I nerd out so bad, but like one of the things that is super, super hot on my like first presence of mine is a fireside chat I just watched. Literally just watched it last night and took some notes this morning. Sam Altman, Howard University, fireside chat with president of Howard University. And I was just on fire because, like, so many of the things that he said were things that I have pretty much, like, this is common sense to me. Like, this is the only way that this makes intuitive sense to me is through those models. Meaning, what does that mean? So we were living our life, and then now technology has been emerging. Technology didn't emerge and then impact us. We designed it, okay? And maybe because we've been marginalized out of the space, we don't think about it that way. But like we created something that is like natural processes. Like mm-hmm. when you think about neural networks, when you think about, my favorite is like, you know, transport level, you know, TCP, UDP, like how I communication again. Like, and so when you boil it down to human processes, because that's what this is designed after.
Yeah.
It's very easy to understand because all you got to think about is how you're living your life and how you are secure, how you're not secure, things that can make you and your belongings and your valuables more secure. And I just like to keep it to be that simple, but like science fiction has had the answer for a long time. I mean, these a lot of people design these systems from science fiction. If you watch science fiction, you will be a lot more smart about current emerging technologies. Hate to say it, but it's true.
Yeah, I agree. Look, we watched The Jetsons.
The Jetsons. I mean, I'm deeply into like Westworld, deeply into The Matrix. I mean, I could watch The Matrix right now and probably come out with new insights. Okay. Like,
cool. Yeah. You definitely would. This company, that they have more of a presence in Cali, but they do mm-hmm. have a presence out here in Plano because they're now mm-hmm. they're actually owned by Toyota. But
oh, nice.
They got a whole smart city in Japan.
Oh, wow. I would love to see that.
Yeah, it's called Susanoo.
Wow. I'm definitely interested. I actually attended a presentation during Black History Month at Howard, and a lot of the professors spoke about some of the cutting-edge research that they were doing, and one thing that really sparked my mind, again, is that human technology interaction.
Like, yeah, because
we're living it, but it's so much there that we need to examine and we need to be critical of.
Yeah, and then if we boil down everything, whether it's from red, purple, blue, orange, all the colors of the rainbow, everything is always predicated on humans' interaction with things.
Absolutely. Security, like if you really want to be red, think about all the ways that you can input something into that product and you will be the best. You'll be the best red teamer you ever could be. If you can sit there and make a list of all the ways that you can input information into any application, you're starting off very stellar as far as red side goes.
So what would be like, whether it be commercial tools, open source tools, concepts, things mm-hmm. that people understand to be, you know, to have a shot at being on the red team?
I'll give one for simplicity's sake, and it's free. I would go PortSwigger. I would go portswigger.net, and forgive me for not being able to state the author's real name, but that was their hacker name back in the day. So they have this seminal, book, and it's a resource book of web application security hacking techniques. This was written 20 years ago. The foundations are still the same.
Yeah. They never change.
But what they did was they created, Burp Suite. So Burp Suite is a proxy tool, but it is like so much more. It is a dynamic testing tool that you can use to proxy, intercept, amend, repeat, intrude, network traffic, essentially. So traffic between your client, a web server, application, API, thin client. And you can stop that traffic and you can look at it. You can play around with it. You can make it do things that it is not intended to do. There is free training. This tool is seminal, integral in penetration testing of web applications, meaning you probably don't do penetration testing without this tool for anyone. That's how major it is. They have a free web application security academy at portswigger.com. Do it. You don't even have to sit for the, you don't even have to sit for their certification, which they do have, and it's $99. So the training is free. The cert is $99. That's what my hiring manager covets right now. I just ask people all kind of questions. I'm like, what cert are you feeling? Like, what cert matters to you, Aaron? He says, Burp Certifier Pro. Got you. So that, like, if you really want, if you're really into it, you do that. You got it for sure. Mm-hmm. And there's so many, the young lady's name is Rania. I can't think of her last name. Full tutorial on YouTube. I have GitHub, study sheets.
We're ready for your tutorials on YouTube.
I'm trying to tell you, I need the fancy setup. So I need some YouTube tips.
You just gotta press record.
I know. Apparently. Now we're coming though. We're coming with that.
I'm surprised you didn't say Kali Linux.
I don't say Kali Linux because I wanted to point to one tool.
Okay.
And what PortSwigger does is it abstracts that away for you. So why you don't need Kali Linux? Because web applications are often rendered in a browser.
Ooh, that would be a good title for a video. Here's why you don't need Kali Linux.
I use Kali Linux. Let's be very clear.
I know.
Like, you want that virtualization. You need that safe space to do this work. You do need it. But if you're just getting started out, like, that's what I did. When I first got started out, I did it from the command line, like a total crazy person, which is very complicated, but it does teach you a lot, right? Like, I'm bringing in the latest version. I'm, you know, setting up the OWASP WebGo application mm-hmm. server. I'm might do an Ubuntu server as an attack machine or a parrot. Like, mm-hmm. so we're doing, like, and you should, this is something that containerization has made so easy for us, and I'm so thankful for it. So yes, you'll get there, but the best tools are the ones that make it as easy as possible. And the reality of the situation is, when you work for an enterprise, your enterprise network could be so tightly configured. Like the blue is blueing in my job. Okay. So there's times when the VM is not going to hit target like I needed to hit target. Why? Because all applications have these different authentication schemas, different flows. Mm-hmm. And if I'm protected the way I need to be protected on the blue side, you're not getting through. That's what makes us secure. That's what you want in a company's mm-hmm. posture, right? That's what you yep. want. However, if you're working red, you're going to be beefing with blue because you're not going to be able to get through. Does that stop the show? No.
No.
Because you have a client, you have a browser, and in that browser, what you can do is you can right click, and this is free game, right click, hit view browser tools or developer tools. You open those developer tools, and there's a lot of noise that you'll see. You won't be acquainted with most of it. But the first thing you should probably do is go to network. The network tab in your developer tools, in your browser tools, will give you the ability to see the HTTP requests and responses that you are sending from your client to the web application server. In a lot of instances, you can stop them. That's how you can do those tricks where you can reload a page to say what you want it to load, what you want it to say. But once you get that server, once it's hitting the server and responding, it's going to flush that out. Like, it's not, that's local to your client. That is not against the server. What PortSwigger's Burp Suite is going to do, and then what that website is going to teach you how to do, is fully use that Burp Suite tool. That tool's also free.
Yeah, it's a no-brainer.
It's a sandbox, so you can also use their browser. Now, it's layers to this. I use their browser on that application, on my VM, on my workstation, not my personal computer. So, but there are exercises that I do on my personal computer. We use the VM, but there is a suite, like hundreds of labs that you can just go to their website and do. And it may acquaint you a bit with virtual machines in Kali, but I don't think that you have to get so deep into Kali. The people that are deeply into Kali are like black hats for sure. Like, those people don't work for enterprises. Like, if you have custom command lines and, like, my, like, I have coworkers who are, like, their stuff is legit. It's, like, super tricked out, personalized, favorite tool sets, favorite scripts, favorite, all of that stuff is cool. But if you want to get started, you want to be simple, just go where that standardized information is, and you can get there. It's a YouTube away. VM, click, drag, open. VirtualBox or VMware Fusion. VMware Fusion for Mac people. Be careful with your M1 chips. That's the second reason. That's a big caveat.
I got a whole gaming machine. Ugh. Because I don't even got an M1 Mac.
You don't want one.
I got an Intel one, and I still couldn't even use a VirtualBox like I used to.
No, you need VMware Fusion. You need VMware Fusion.
That wasn't working either.
We'll talk about it because it should be turnkey.
Didn't matter. It was a reason for me to get another Windows machine.
You get what's it, Parallels?
I got Parallels. It wasn't working like on Parallels either. I didn't care though.
We didn't talk about it. What image did you get? Like, I don't know. Like, what image did you pull down?
But I got my Mac in early 2021.
I got mine in 2020, and mine's just still that VMware Fusion is doing just fine.
It wasn't, no, I lied. They work, but what I needed to do, this was a malware analysis course.
Oh, okay.
What I need to set up with to do the network parameters and stuff, it was not corroborated.
I got you.
And so that's why I say, you know what, let me just go get a Windows machine and
yes, and a lot of people will tell you that too. I'm not a Windows girly, but again, I'm a VM girly, so if I need a Windows, I'll go get one.
Right. Yeah. And even in Parallels, because of something, it was not letting me configure it the way I need to pretty much isolate my network. Yeah. Like I needed to. So mm-hmm. I was like, I'm not finna.
Yeah.
I spent hours and crap of troubleshooting trying to do that.
That's like, what I'm saying. Like that OWASP WebGo configuration by yourself, command line life. Woo. Right. Like, just telling that story to a recruiter should impress them. You don't have to be Mr. Robot, you know, to prove that you have a legit interest and that you can, you know, manage your way through the stress of learning something new and just, you know, speaking to the one simple win I successfully mounted. Like,
yeah, definitely. So we're rounding out the end of the conversation. What's one question you wish I would have asked you that I didn't ask you?
That's a good question. You look at you getting your marketing, your market research. Dang, that's a good question.
Everybody always does that when I ask the question because I like sometimes
you're a good interviewer. You are. One question. I guess if I had like a seminal piece of advice, like if I had just one thing, which is even like I'm gonna stump myself trying to think of it.
Yeah, and that's typically kind of what I like. After this question, it's typically the what's like what you want to leave the watchers with.
Ding ding. Well, I'm on point. Okay. Yeah. What would I leave them with? I think just really, really try. You know, give yourself the opportunity to try because you really don't know what you know until you try it. Even if it's taking that first practice exam, even if it's trying that free course, even if it's just reading that article, just give yourself the opportunity to try. Because I think that, you know, I'm one of those like sappy people. I do believe in our inherent capabilities. And I think that we all want, you know, a level of security and safety. Shoot, that's half the reason why a lot of people want to be in cybersecurity because they want to enjoy a level of stability and security. So I don't know, just try. People get overwhelmed. Do not let the plethora of information, do not let the information overwhelm you, but just, you know, start simple and just give it a try.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And where can they follow you at?
Okay. They can follow me on Instagram at cybersecurity_babe. You can find me at cybersecuritybabe.com. You can find me on LinkedIn as Tiffany Savage, MBA. And you can follow me on X at cybersecure_babe. What other platforms do I have?
Are you on Threads?
I'm on Threads at cybersecurity_babe. And I am on TikTok as cybersecurity_babe.
Perfect, perfect. And guys, I know you want to hear about her boutique. We had some difficulties recording today. So what I'm thinking is that we'll probably do somewhere we do like a part two where we go live. Kind of like I did with Markeisha that you guys really enjoyed. And I think that'll be beneficial. So if you guys want to see that live, please let us know in the comments if you want us to go live in the coming months and talk to you then. Also, for my fellas, do not DM her nothing weirdo type stuff.
Please don't.
Please don't.
She's gonna get blocked.
Right. If, just don't. Like, just be normal, all right? That's all I'm going to tell you.
Don't be weird.
But this has been another episode of Textual Talk. You know, like we always say, stay ahead of the game. Until next time, we out. Peace.